Before we get started with today's show, I want to tell you about another great ESPN podcast, The C.J. McCollum Show, where every week, New Orleans Pelicans star C.J. McCollum discusses names and storylines in and around the NBA with inside perspective you can only get from someone in the locker room and on the floor. That's The C.J. McCollum Show. Listen where you are listening to this podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. It is that time of week. We have a guest join us, coming to us live from Meadowlark Media and ESPN. Howard Bryant, what's going on, man?
Good morning. Good morning. How you doing, Bo?
I'm good, man. Yeah, I want to, I'm going to talk a little bit about this Deion stuff, you know, as we go in this. But how much can we tell the people about the project you're working on right now?
Virtually nothing.
Nothing at all?
No, we can say something, of course.
I don't mean details, but like the big thing that you work at all, because I just think it's one of the coolest projects somebody could do.
Yes, I'm working on the date most people don't know exists, July 18th, 1949. Jackie Robinson goes to Washington to testify to the House Un-American Activities Committee against Paul Robeson, who supposedly said that it is inconceivable that Negroes would fight a war for the United States against the Soviet Union. And they brought Jackie in to put Paul Robeson in his place. One of the great moments in history uncovered.
Man, like, one, I encourage people, like, the one thing I could suggest is there's the documentary you can find on YouTube by Paul Robeson. I don't remember the title, but it's directed by St. Clair Bourne. I recommend people check that out because Paul Robeson's the baddest man. I cannot imagine how terrifying that big was at that time. Like, I'm bigger than you. I am an incredible world-class athlete. I have a singing voice that is unmatched, and I am scared of absolutely nothing, right?
Oh, I also have a law degree.
Yeah. Yeah, I forgot about that part. My bad. And this is in the early 20th century. Now, one thing that St. Clair Bourne documentary points out is a man of missteps, right? Like, this is not
very
a
many.
Plaster saint, right? Made some trades at different points that are trades that people make, but when I talk to you about the different things that you come across in the research on it, I find myself so struck in so many ways about things that go on that are like right now. You know what I mean? Like the parallels of what go on for the man that decides to do this, the way that owners look at race and everything else that surrounds it. It is just wild to me when I hear you talk about it. Like, wow, it kind of is the 40s.
It's the 40s. It's the 20s. Yeah, it's wild. It's wild. And I think what's great about it, too, is that, you know, these types of stories don't get told. They never get told. And we act like it happened a million years ago. It didn't happen a million years ago. And a lot of the different themes are still happening today. And one of the things, you know, as we're about to talk about Deion, one of the things that I find really interesting about it is the Black reaction to other Black people publicly. And the sort of all the stakes that are involved in that, you know, it's not the same. You know, when you criticize each other or when you do something that runs counter to what everybody thinks you should do, or when white America puts you in a position to go after your own for their reasons. Let's just say things get hot.
Yeah. And Jackie Robinson got caught in an okie doke. That, I mean, to be fair, he didn't really have much of an option on it, right? Government say, hey, Jackie, you want to come in here and testify? How you feel about that?
Exactly. Oh, and who's telling me? My employer, Branch Rickey. How am I going to say no?
Right, right. And if you read Jackie's autobiography, he talks about the various conflicts that he has and, like, ultimate regret that came from the way that it was all done with him. But when the Kyrie thing was going on, I talked to you about this and I talked about this on the show that I think what I think, and I'm going to say what I think generally speaking. Now, I'm not one of those people, like, sometimes you got to look up and be like, hey, being right ain't that important, right? And he's like, no, I'm going to pass on this one. But with Kyrie, I quickly saw the okie doke at play. And it was like, nah, not going to do that there. Nope, not going
to. No, smartest move, maybe, I mean, I'm not ranking it, but one of the smartest moves of the year, right? In terms of, yeah, I tell my son this all the time. The world doesn't need to know everything you're thinking,
Yes.
especially because in these situations, you're being brought up there, not because of what you think, but because of what we need you to say.
Right.
They're not the same thing.
And that's what I saw in the Kyrie was they're like, yo, we got to get somebody to do this. But white folks ain't really want to get on that because it's always this close to being about something else. You know what I mean? So, hey, highly respected Afro-American, how'd you like to give your take that I just heard and may not even fully understand, but it's close enough to where we want to go? And so I was passing on stuff like that, right? So this Deion Sanders thing comes up. And I did an appearance on CNN last week. And we talked about Jerry Jones. And, you know, I said what I had to say about Jerry Jones. But then they were like, hey, we'd like you to come on again next week, right? Before we have any idea what there is to talk about, we want you to come on next week. I say, cool. Not sure if you guys heard, but I do have a television show to promote, right? So, like, these are things that over the last few years, I don't really do too many of these appearances anymore, but I got other things to do. Okay, cool. I come in. So they say they want to talk about Dion. I'm like, oh, that's interesting. And the question was, is Dion a sellout? And I'm like, well, no, of course not, right? We could do that. But what I didn't expect is that the word sellout would be on the screen the entire time I talk. And that's a lot to ask people who are primarily watching 2 minutes of a 9-minute clip and don't hear the part where I say, no, I don't think he's a sellout, and then get into what the things are that I'm talking about. But they see the 2 minutes and all it says is sellout at the bottom of the screen. And you got
Or
people
they're at
like,
the gym with the
yes,
volume down and just
right.
looking at the word sellout while
Right.
they're on
Not
the elliptical.
seeing the question mark at the end, right? And in many cases, what I find to be interesting, not giving your boy any benefit of the doubt. Like, if you don't know who I am and you're unfamiliar with my work, that's one thing. But some of y'all been around for a minute. And I'm like, yo, I would have thought that you would pretty readily know and recognize that, no, I ain't gonna be the one out here. Like, the term sellout, as I'm saying, I would have taken the Colorado job too. But anyway, I get out there and I say what I have to say. And the response, this is wild, man. I'm not exaggerating it. At least it doesn't feel like it. The only thing in my like real public career that I can think of that has gone as viral as this Dion thing has
Was
was the
t-shirt.
Donald Sterling thing in 2014.
More than the t-shirt?
Maybe that. But I'm thinking less like that's easy, right? Like that's just a picture, you know, it just kind of goes out or whatever it is. But in terms of something I was actually saying, this is like the number one that I can recall in getting around and like looking at the numbers. The last time I checked, we were recording this at 10:15 Eastern Time on Wednesday, December the 7th, and that thing had 2.7 million views on the tweets. And that's before we get to the people who like hijacked it and put it up on their own. You know what I mean? God knows if it made it to WorldStar. Who knows what's going on with the Reels and the TikToks and all of this stuff, right? It is the most viral thing that I've done. But what's a couple of things have been interesting, and I want to later get into like why it is that this is such a viral topic, because that has been the thing that has shocked me. But not just the bots, but a significant number of people who watched that clip and were like, the white man put you on TV to tear another black man down.
Yeah,
And
you
I'm
were at
sitting
the
there, but I'm sitting there, Howard, and I'm like, don't you see these white people on this stage pushing back on me? Like, don't you see Don Lemon pushing back on me? You think the conspiracy was to have me come out here and tear down Deion Sanders when Deion Sanders did what white people in power would absolutely prefer, which is to take someone who is very talented from a black institution and then bring him to a white one, so that the black talent that would go to the black institution and the
would
attention
follow.
and the money now comes to a white institution. But I'm the one doing the white man's work.
Which, by the
Oh.
way, is the history of the HBCU in sports.
Yo, that's what I'm saying. Like, it's so, like, the response in every way was so bizarre to me. And I guess part of this is, like, obviously the magnitude of Deion Sanders and, like, the idea, the notion of the charismatic individual and how roped in people got to the idea of him. But it wasn't about the cause, it was about Deion. And so part of what like disappoints me in some of the response that I've seen, and I don't think that people peep this level of game themselves about what I feel like is going on here, is I was speaking in defense of the black college, right? From the very beginning, I have spoke in defense of the black college, in defense of the mission of the black college, and asking for Deion Sanders to buy in to that.
Of which you are an alumnus.
Right. Well, I'm an alumnus, but also I'm a black person that grew up around HBCU. So like, even if I didn't go to one, I got it's the world that I'm of, right?
That's
like,
right.
That was what I was asking of Deion. And you can go back and there were things I was mad about. And there were things that I was like, I hope he doesn't do this. You know, I was fairly pointed and strided into criticism. I have no problem acknowledging that, but it was always in the name of black folks in this black institution that I think has done so much, not just for black people, but honestly for America. And the response was, well, why can't he go get his money? But somehow I'm the one doing the work for the white man. Like, this is just the responses to this, I think, are so convoluted and all over the place, because I don't think people know what they're supposed to think. But I think in the end, their loyalties are to Deion Sanders over the black institution, which is really, really strange.
Yeah, I think there's a few things at work. And I think you're right. I mean, that there is, this is one of those stories where you got to step back and ask yourself, which you should do on all stories, but where we have to step back and go, what's happening? Like, what's actually sort of taking place right now? And on the one hand, the first thing for me is that I think we have to remember the moment in time we're in. And this is going to be the moment in time we're in is shaping a lot of how people are reacting. Post George Floyd, there has been this moment, movement. We've heard about it, like reviving the HBCUs. And we've been hearing about this for years before that. But really, the George Floyd moment really suddenly made this push. And remember, there was all this talk about the HBCU as the antidote to the imbalances in power that African Americans have with their lack of coaching and opportunities, et cetera, at the PWI, in the PWI space. And so there has been this feeling that the HBCU is the savior, and that the people who return to it or who gravitate toward it are somehow responsible for its revival, and that there's a movement taking place for that. Even though we know and have always known, and you and I talked about this, Jackson State was never going to become Alabama, or threaten Alabama, or become some satellite parallel universe to Alabama, right? This wasn't the game. In fact, you and I think we were on your show a couple of years ago talking about how the goal of the HBCU is to actually educate, right? That's where your lane is. That's the space where, you know, that's your historical space for those institutions. So the idea, as we started moving in, that, oh yeah, all the black talent is going to rebalance by going home, it was never going to happen. And yet, but that is the romance of it. So when Eddie George went down there, when Hugh Jackson went down there, when Deion Sanders went down to the different schools, it seemed to feel like it was picking up some sort of momentum that really doesn't have a basis in any sort of historical fact. One, because the resources are so different. Then there's the other thing, which is the idea that what black coaching really needs and what the HBCU really needs is to have Deion Sanders walk the walk. Because remember, this is how he sold himself. He didn't sell himself going to HBCUs as, this is going to be the first step in my coaching career. That wasn't the marketing plan. The marketing plan was he was coming here to create something for everybody, not for himself, which runs counter to anything that we know about Deion. Deion comes first. And so there's that. And there was a little tiny bit, I don't want to put them in the same sentence, but I feel there's a certain analogy here to the reaction to Barack Obama, when he was cashing in off his presidency, which they all do now, right? I mean, Jimmy Carter is the only one who doesn't post, you know, Reagan, although he's pre-Reagan, but of that generation, the post-Watergate president, part of the game is to make a ton of money off your presidency. And people, when anybody called that out, that, you know, I think this is kind of messed up. How come you want to let Obama get his money? Why, you know, get your hand out of his pocket, whatever, all of that stuff. And so when Dion says, okay, I'm out the door and I'm going to go to what is essentially a mediocre Power Five school, but it's still a Power Five school. And the message is their money is longer than your money, which is true. Then I can see why people would be like, well, how come he's not allowed to earn? Well, he is allowed to earn, but you got to factor in all these other things too as part of the moment in time, which sort of explains all these different reactions.
And don't forget that he got that job in the shadow of George Floyd and was talking that talk with that in the air. Like, yeah, that was part of it, was that it was in this time and, you know, God called him to come and do this for HBCUs to level the playing field. You Google Dion, level the playing fields, you'll find the quote. Like, it's not this, that's him. I think you and I both can do math. Thereby, the money that he took was so much more than the money that he was receiving. And I don't think that anybody can begrudge somebody for making a move under those circumstances, right? I don't think that anyone can.
And is anyone begrudging him? And that's the other thing. Is that piece of it actually happening?
No, I haven't seen that. But I think this is another topic where the outrage machine has decided that this is a one. Like, after I do this podcast, I'm going to be on TMZ to talk about this. And that's strictly a result, I would think, of them looking at the virality of it and realizing
what's hot.
This is hot. This is the thing. Like, to the point where I hit the team and we're like, yo, you sure about this? Like, I don't know. Like, if they, you know, we talked about it and we're like, yeah, okay, we think that we can, like, probably go ahead and we can make this, you know, it won't be, I don't want to be misframed and I don't want to be caught in a situation to try people trying to get me to say something that I never said and didn't mean in the first place. But, like, we think it's going to be okay. So you can hear me right now talking about it. If it don't go right, I'm telling you, I'm giving you in advance. Like, hey, man, I was like, I don't know, but I think we're going to do it.
And also, there's tons of stories, tons of ideas where no matter what you say, people are hearing something, what they want to hear something different. Dude. They're hearing what they want to hear. And I think with this story, one of the first things that hit me when Dion went down there in the first place, and we were talking about this HBCU renaissance, and I was like, is it? And people were talking about how the balance of power was shifting because now Black people are beginning to take back their talent and utilize their talent to bring it back to their community. I'm like, is that what's happening? And so, you know, as you start thinking about this, you realize that how much of this is actually about Dion and how much of this is actually about us, how much of it is really about the romance that we have. And this goes back to the Negro Leagues in a lot of ways. When you go back and think about how things went sideways, you take the Black talent from the Negro Leagues, you bring them to Major League Baseball, but you kill the infrastructure. No Black doctors, no Black managers, no Black GMs, no Black ticket takers, but you take the talent. You take the talent from the HBCUs in football. You take the Ozzie Newsoms and you take the Walter Paytons and you take the Jerry Rices and you take all of them, but you leave the infrastructure alone. You're not hiring Black coaches to come along. You're not investing in the HBCU. And so now the HBCU feels like a reparation in some ways now, right? Post George Floyd. Right. And so all of these things are happening at once. And then the North Star that you've got is now going to a 1-11 team because that mediocrity is better than your 27-5 excellence over the last couple seasons.
Yeah. Cause their mediocrity pay like $5 million a year. I get it. You know what I mean? If Dion brings the staff, as he has said he wants to bring the staff, if he brings this heavily Black staff, then he has done something that honestly most people don't have the power to do under those circumstances.
That's right.
Somebody is going to come to him and be like, yo, you might want to get a white dude or two.
Or two. And especially there. Because yes. Let's also remember the history of a lot of the Black players haven't really had it easy up in Boulder. You know, it's not like you're going to a place that has a long tradition of really black participation, of comfort. You know, you're going to Colorado. I mean, there's a lot going on there, right? So there's that. And I think the other thing too that has to be considered when it comes to someone like Dion is there was a romance that he was going to be Eddie Robinson. I don't know where that really came from, but a lot of people did buy into the idea that he was going to create a tentpole here. He was going to be an anchor. This was going to be a model. And over the next 5 or 6 or 7 years, we were going to look back and look at this moment as the moment where the star players did something they had never done before, which was use their star power to bring it back to the black community. And Dion was actually perfect in some of these ways, because if there was one thing that people knew about him, it was like, well, he don't really need the money. He's not, you know, he can actually afford to take that sacrifice. And then he didn't take that sacrifice.
Yeah. And I mean, here's the thing I say about the taking the sacrifice. Yeah, he could afford to take the sacrifice. You are correct. But what nobody talks about when they get into Dion did this, and the notion that I've never actually seen verified about Dion donating back his salary, or a portion of his salary. How much you think that Affleck deal is worth? Because I think I'm assuming that Affleck deal is worth multiple millions of dollars, which he would not get if he was not at Jackson State, which, by the way, makes it a bit easier for you to donate half your salary back. Anybody that's donating half their salary back is somebody who got a lot of side money coming in.
And also it's like and that's the other thing that people get all upset about, which is, why are you spending my money? Right? It was like the time when Jason Giambi was going to sign with the Yankees, and I walked up to him and I was like, gee, okay, the Yankees are offering you $120 million. And the A's are offering you 113. And if you're happy here, I mean, what's the difference between 120 and $113 million? And he looked at me and he said, $7 million.
Yeah, the idea of diminishing marginal utility is not in the world of most people when it comes to these things. But I do want to talk about that point of an HBCU renaissance, because I think a thing that's been lost in this is HBCU enrollments across the board have been up. Post George Floyd, applications have been up post George Floyd. We're talking like double digits.
That's attributable to George Floyd, not Deion Sanders.
Right, right. And see, that's the thing. Like there was a larger moment that was there that he wound up being a part of. That again, I think has kind of been lost and forgotten when we get to talking about this, because now it is as it always was, and it just becomes a thing of talking about Dion. He really moves the needle in a way that I am shocked that he still does in 2022. We got to remember, man, Dion Sanders got drafted almost 35 years ago.
And has not played a game since what, 96, 97? No, he was with the Ravens in 99,
yeah, yeah, he had that, right? He had that comeback in the early 2000s, right?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. And this is with us having been around at the height of the fame of Deion Sanders, which is something that I think is kind of difficult to explain to people, like, especially given that baseball was a bigger deal to the median American than it is right now. He was not a Hall of Fame baseball player, and not even really an all-star caliber baseball player, but at his best, he was a very good baseball player.
And I'm going to disagree with you there.
You think he's all-star caliber?
Because if Deion could play.
Oh, no. What I mean is if he had played all the time, think so, yes, right?
That's
I'm just talking about.
He had All-Star written all over him, though. Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, I think he led the league in triples playing like half the season 1 year with the Giants, I think, or something.
No, it was with the Braves. He had something like 14 triples in 90 games.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Deion Sanders legging out a triple is one of the most the triple is still the most entertaining play that baseball has to offer you. And let it be Deion Sanders, the one legging out that triple, and then the throw to try to get him at third goes in the dugout, and now he's walking to the plate.
Yep. And because he could play like at the level, there were a lot of people. And then obviously when he went off in Dallas and San Francisco and Dallas and obviously Atlanta. But there were people who were like, if he sticks to baseball, he could be a great player. Not a good player. He'd be a great player. Because it wasn't as though he couldn't really hit. He was putting 40% of his time into baseball.
Right.
It was still really good.
With a broken down body.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, that's the part that gets lost. The reason Deion riding around on that scooter, right, is he put a lot of miles on his body. Like, the idea that Deion Sanders was an elite corner for as long as he was an elite corner. Because, I mean, you'll think of a Champ Bailey, you'll think of a Daryl Green, you'll be able to pull up some names of those guys that are elite corners and stay elite corners. But if you watched what Garrett Wilson did to Patrick Peterson over the weekend, mm-hmm. you are reminded it's hard to stay good as an elite corner. He wasn't like Deion Sanders all the way through 2000. But when you add in the fact he was playing those baseball years and playing wide receiver as a like not just over putting him in on a trick play, but there were a year or two where he was an actual wide receiver. Yo, he was so famous, right? The idea that a cornerback was seen as a cornerback swung the balance of power from the 49ers to from the Cowboys to the 49ers and then back again.
And then back to the Cowboys.
Mm-hmm. Based on what Deion Sanders did.
No, no doubt. Well, I mean, that whole shutdown corner island thing is Deion's. I mean, they weren't doing that with Rod Woodson back in the early on. They weren't doing that with corners back then, even though they were great corners. But this whole, you can't throw to my side of the field for 60 minutes?
Yeah.
I mean, that was Deion. And you also can't throw to my side of the field, even if Jerry Rice is over there?
Well. Here's the tricky thing about Deion. You can't throw to my side of the field, but you can throw to the other side of the field where Jerry Rice is lighting Charles Toast Demery up for five touchdowns. If there's anything I will never forgive Deion Sanders for in this world, it's Charles Toast Demery getting lit up on the other side and Deion got his thumb in his ass on the other half watching it happen. I still don't know to this day how in the world that was allowed to happen, but it did eventually get to a point where, no, maybe you shouldn't throw it to Jerry Rice either. But he had to get his heart up before he was ready for that.
Well, cornerbacks, you can make an argument that cornerbacks are sort of like the closers in baseball. They got that window where they're unbeatable for a short amount of years. But during that period, they're as good as they've ever been, right? They're as good as it gets. Like, you know, there was a time people were talking about Josh Norman as the guy, right? There's always been that guy. The same way there's been that guy for the first couple of years who's unhittable coming in the eighth, ninth inning. And then over time, exposure begins to level things out. But no doubt. I mean, Deion was the guy, because I think what people forget about Deion, and it is that height of fame thing, right? Because it's a pre-internet height of fame. It's nascent cable height of fame, where he was the three network guy. Like, three network fame is a big deal. You know, and people don't get that today because you've got streamers and 8 gazillion channels. But three network fame, when everybody knows who you are, when there's only, you know, CBS, ABC and NBC, different thing. And also, you know, he's coming up at the time when rap is coming up, too. He's in all them, you know, Hammer videos and everything else. And he played for the Yankees.
He did.
Right. I mean, he's everywhere.
Well,
showing up in a helicopter.
Hold on. He also played for the Braves. And in terms of talking about fame, especially as Deion Sanders, they were on television all across America and winning all the time.
And at a time when Black Atlanta was on the ascent.
And really into the Braves.
That's right.
All right. The helicopter from the football game to go to the baseball game and all of that stuff. I mean, look.
And that was a playoff game, wasn't it?
That was a playoff game. And don't forget this. In 1988, when Deion Sanders was a college senior, he pulls up to the Florida State, Florida game in a limo wearing the tuxedo. Like, he had figured out how to leverage the media game before anybody else did. What he was wearing at the draft, that crazy Sports Illustrated cover that looked like a Pen and Pixel No Limit album cover, except it was 1989. And he said at the time, cornerbacks weren't making any money, and he decided that he was going to play this up. Like, his ability to promote has always been unparalleled. And that's where the Colorado thing is going to be interesting, because he is going to get them shine and attention like they've never had. And that, to me, that's what I wanted to get back to. One thing I'm finding interesting in the responses about Deion is how many people's thing is, look at all the attention he gave to HBCUs, right? Now, number one, he didn't give attention to HBCUs. He gave attention to HBCU, okay? HBCU. How many players can you name on Jackson State's team? They play in North Carolina Central in that Celebration Bowl. How many players can you name on that team? Yeah, you can name his kids, right? How many people can you name, like, figures, not just pay, coaches, players, whatever it is, from the rest of the SWAC? Eddie George is there at Tennessee State. Did you know that? How many players on his team can you name? How many players on Hugh Jackson's team can you name? Did you watch the Bayou Classic this year because of Jackson State? Like, he brought attention to HBCU, okay? And I don't blame him for that, because the job of promoting all of them was too big. Just don't give him too much credit for something that did not happen. But in this day and age, the most valuable currency is attention, right? Like, when people talk about the attention economy, the idea that Deion got people to look at Jackson State while he was there, I think for a lot of people, it gets no better than that, because what they want is to be seen. What they want is to be famous. And so to me, the thing is, he did that. He was seen. But once he goes, all the eyeballs are going to follow him, and you're not going to stick around with Jackson State, right? It's like those people who don't really like reggae but love Bob Marley, right? Bob
Marley dies,
and suddenly you're not out there going to go find more reggae. You had your reggae dude, and now your reggae dude is out of there. You waiting for Legend to come out, and then boom, that's what you're going to do, and you're going to play it, you know, when you smoke weed with your friends in college. Like, well, that's what that's going to be. But that's what Deion did, though, is there was a level of attention that he received, and it was great for Jackson State at the time for them to draft off of it. Like, there's no question that Jackson State got a lot out of Deion's presence, but I am struck by just how universally a lot of people believe that people looking at you is the height of all of this. So nothing matter more than people looking at you.
But there's and there's a couple other things at work there too. Like, number one, you know, what you're describing is no different than watching Tiger Woods. Are you watching golf or are you watching him? You're watching him. And once he's not there, how much golf are you watching?
Right.
Now, maybe there's some dudes who stick around and go, hey, I kind of like the sport. But for the most part, that cult of personality is about the person. And I think the other thing is, and I didn't finish this point, I don't think I finished this point well, but I'll try it again, is that there is a historic nostalgia and want for Black people that this moment has created. And it does go back to the Negro Leagues, where you took the Negro League talent and you left the Negro Leagues to die. You took the Black talent from the HBCUs, and then you just forgot about the HBCUs, because now, you know, once Alabama is going to start, you know, recruiting Black players, then we don't need Alabama State anymore. We don't need the North Carolina AT&T. We don't need the rest of them. And this post-George Floyd moment, this post-Trump moment, felt like a way to get some of that back. Felt like a way for Black people to begin to have some more self-determination, to begin to use those resources to say, wait a minute, we've got ability, we've got talent, and our talent has a price tag on it. Our talent does have value. And if there can be a movement, you know, started by a famous player, because you do need a Pied Piper, right? You do need somebody to say this can work. And so I think a lot of people put a lot of emotional currency into it. And I don't just mean Black people. I mean, a lot of guilty white people who were like, hey, yeah, this is right. This is important. We did take all the talent and leave everything left behind. And maybe this is recompense. Maybe there is a moment right here where something special can happen. And then Deion goes to Colorado and we'll be back to square one. Right. And so I think there is a feeling like a letdown, like, okay, well, it feels a bit like a gut punch to those people who bought into this possibility of this moment in time.
So something interesting that I was looking at with Deion and his recruiting at Jackson State, and I hadn't paid much attention to what the recruiting was this year. We all know what it was. And look, my buddy Joel Anderson was looking at this, that 24/7, one of the recruiting sites, has like a talent index to like determine like some index to give you an aggregate of how much talent each team has. Mm-hmm. And Jackson State was at like 130 or something like that. And that is absurdly high for a school of that level. Right. Deion. And I think part of that, obviously, with Hunter is probably skewed there with Hunter and the kids. But something that I found surprising about his time there, like I'm looking at the top 20 players in the state of Mississippi for the year of 2023. So next year's incoming class. Right. None of them are going to Jackson State.
Mm-hmm.
Not a single one. if I go now and I look at the top 20 players from the year 2022 from the state of Mississippi, none of them are going to Jackson State. And I find that a bit surprising because the Mississippi schools, they were able to get boys to come later, the Mississippi SWAC schools, in part because the SEC Mississippi schools were really holding on to that racism real tight. Right. Like, you're asking for a lot to me to go play a game under the stars and bars every week. You know what I mean? But I am surprised, actually, though, that he was able to get, like, this great player from out of state to come there. And I don't know if they were, maybe they weren't trying or whatever it is. But, like, aside from the we can be big time, because I just don't think that matters, I do look at Deion's time at Jackson State, and not just him, but anybody else who gets that job later. This would apply to them. I would just lock in as hard as I can on the idea and the mission and try to get as many of the good players from the state of Mississippi as I possibly can. Because what we did learn in this, man, if you didn't know it, it's a lot of people that really care a lot about Jackson State football. A lot about Jackson State football. It may be a 10 or 15 year plan in doing it, but hit the ground and get as many of the players from your own state as you possibly can, because you can't win the SEC strictly with Mississippi players, right? There just aren't enough good players in Mississippi for you to do that. But I bet you can win the SWAC.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. 100%. And I think the other part of that, while you were talking, is you also have to talk about the rest of the school. Like, part of me, and obviously being from Massachusetts, it's a different, the relationship with HBCU is very different.
We know, Howard, you just called it North Carolina AT&T. We are aware.
NC18. I don't know how to call it.
Carolina AT&T. All you got to
I said AT&T. You got to get that out.
You said, no, leave it in.
No, you got to get that out.
Leave it in. It helps sell the point. AT&T.
I didn't talk about no phone company. Come on, man.
No.
I do me like that. You know that was a mistake.
We left it in when I thought you said slaves instead of slades.
How you gonna do it? You know how much hate I'm about to get
now. No, now you're gonna get the love because you're coming back around on it. For people who don't know, how I was trying to talk about Bill Russell, and he's like, yeah, he owned Slades in Boston. And I was like, he owned what? He's like, Slades. Oh, Slades with a D. I thought he said Bill Russell owned slaves. And I just couldn't, like, you said Bill Russell pimping? Like, I couldn't figure out what in the world Bill Russell was out here doing.
Goodness.
Anyway, continue. We understand.
Apologize to my people for this. It was a mistake. Damn it. Mistake. You know. Anyway, my cousin went to Johnson C. Smith. That counts.
Yeah.
So, but that's the other point, right? Is when we're starting to talk about the whole package. You know, there was a part of me that was like, okay, I was starting to get mad about it because I was like, this isn't charity. And this whole feeling has been like, oh, we have to go help the HBCUs. We got to help them, you know? And it's like, oh, wait a minute. There's an entire educational foundation in history here, right? And if you're going to try to compete for players, I thought you were also trying to compete for students, right? There's a whole thing here, which goes back to your point about why are we actually doing this? Do you really believe that trying to go out and get every great player in Mississippi or Alabama or competing with Clemson is actually the mission of the historically black college and university, right? And so I've always sort of been a little skeptical about overlaying the sports mission with the mission, because the mission itself has not changed.
Well, you know what happened there, right? This is something that I've become aware of in this and probably knew already, but this is an important distinction. And this is something that I'm not sure as somebody not from the South would get this, right? Where you from, black culture and white culture are largely different things, right? Like, they're different wings of what the white culture is up there too, because immigration plays much more of a role in why, right? But black culture and white culture are not really the same.
Black culture and white culture ain't the same in Boston.
Yeah, but in the South, black culture and white culture are basically the same, right? Like, the overlap is all there, right? We're basically all and of the same things or whatever. Which is to say, we, my people, act about football in the South the same way they do. Ridiculously.
That's right?
Like every ridiculous thing and every little small, tiny defensive attitude that I ever see when you say something about Auburn has come out about Jackson State in the exact same way. That has been more interesting than anything else for me to watch. It's just like, oh, we really are the exact same kind of crazy. This ain't one we can blame on them no more, folks. No, sir, Rebob. You go check the SWAC message boards and all of that stuff, and it's like, oh, no. We really do all kick it the same. Like, if you need to make the point that we ain't really that different, it goes right there. By the way,
that's a great point because and that's a weather thing too, and because half the people up here are playing hockey right now.
Yes,
you know what I mean. And so it's not like there is the shared history of black and white on the East Coast. Given a few pockets here and there, but especially like in a place like Boston, is really only 120 years old. It ain't 400 years old.
Right.
It's 110 years old in terms of like big, big numbers. I mean, obviously the black people lived in Boston in the 1700s, but I mean, in terms of actual culture, I mean, it's really not that long.
Right.
Where you've had, you know, serious, I mean, the post-Great Migration is only 52 years old.
And by the way, we wasn't really trying to come with y'all like that in the Great Migration that tough anyway. Like, 100%. It is like people got to New York. Like, no. My man got halfway there. Yeah, my man got halfway there and was like, nah, it's just a little bit too cold. And turned back around.
We in Canada yet? Not even close, son. we got a long way to go. You know? My grandmother said, why'd you stop? She's one of them from Barbados. And that's what I said. Black Boston ain't the same because of the Caribbean influence up there. Right. You go to Boston, you got Haitians, Jamaicans, Bajans, you know, and African
Cape Verde deep.
And don't even bring up the Cape Verdeans, you know, because the Andrades and the Silvas and the Lopeses did not get along with the Jacksons and the Johnsons and the Bryants. You know, that took some time.
Yeah, have we had our discussion of was Wayne Fonts passing?
Exactly, right?
For people don't remember Wayne Fonts. Wayne Fonts got counted. I don't remember him being counted at the time. Because Wayne Fonts, for those of you who don't remember, Wayne Fonts was the coach of the Lions in the late 80s and early 90s. Like the Barry Sanders era, Wayne Fonts is that. And if you look at a picture of Wayne Fonts, that is a black man. Wayne Fonts is from Cape Verde, right? But he got that job before Art Shell got that job. But Art Shell was the first black head coach by every metric. And that's why I'm asking, was Wayne Fonts passing?
But he didn't.
No, Wayne Fonts had that job before Art Shell. Art Shell got that job in the middle of 1989 after they fired Mike Shanahan. And per the wiki, Wayne Fonts got that job in Detroit in 1988.
Mm-hmm.
I have never seen him regarded as a hero or a pioneer, but I'm telling you right now, I'm looking at a picture of that man, and if this is Louisiana... He black man.
That's right. Well, and that's why I always say when I went to college, when I went to Philly, I was like, I'm only 5.5 hours away from home, but where's the Andrades at? Where's the Fernandez? Where's the Fonts? Where's the Lopes? Where's the Andrades? Right. I mean, that's go talk to Davey Lopes because he's from down there. Davey Lopes is down from East Providence. Mm-hmm. And so that area is, you know, and Wayne Fonts is part of that.
He's from New Bedford, Massachusetts.
From New Bedford, absolutely.
Half an hour from my house. He went to Michigan State at that time where Michigan State was taking the black people. The other people were not taken. Just want to point that out. I think Wayne Fonts went in there and he's like, oh, from Cape Verde. And they're like, oh, that sounds like Europe. You know, Americans don't know nothing about no geography. Like, everyone's like, you're black. No, I'm from Cape Verde, right? And every time they do it, he just... shrug his shoulders. He brought his brothers along. They got jobs. And I'm like, yo, what are y'all going to have a bad hair day and mess it up for everybody?
Mm-hmm. They'd be like, man, did I see some waves in there?
That's all I'm saying. Every day he in there, you know, it's like, well, play the music.
Thank you for your patience. A representative from the right time will be with you shortly. Your current hold time is
15 seconds.
But yeah, you put a picture of Wayne Fonts and that dude next to each other, and you're going to think they brothers, and you're going to think they brothers, but neither one of them ever were treated as brothers.
As brothers, no doubt. And it's interesting because whenever I was making my list, I always put Wayne Fonts on it. But you're right. In terms of chronology, he don't count.
Like I say, I ain't seen nothing in any February about how, you know, this was a big thing. I'm looking at the legacy part of his wiki page, and it's just all about his personality and his popularity. And by the way, it worked out well for him because let me tell you something. He started off his first two full seasons. He went 7-9 and 6-10. Black Wayne Fonts gets fired after that. Instead, Cape Verdean Wayne Fonts stuck around to go 12-4, get the NFC Championship game, and win the only Lions playoff game of my life.
That's right. And they beat the Cowboys in the playoffs that year, didn't they?
They smoked them.
They smoked them. They crushed them.
And then themselves got smoked by maybe the best professional football team I've ever seen. The 91 Commandos.
91, yeah, Washington.
Yes, yes, yes. But yeah, no, Wayne Fonts, the hero. Maybe he might be out here like I joke about Jaren Collins. Like, hey, man.
Hey, what about me?
I ain't no hero, all right? Now, with Jaren Collins, he's making a different point about why he's not a hero. But Wayne Fonts, like, no. Shh, 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 shh.
Exactly.
I am an ordinary football coach.
I'm just a ball coach. That's it.
I don't even understand why people talking about color.
It's funny because it's like, and it all comes back to, if we just do a little quick history lesson, what's always funny about that is that little period right there all comes back to one man, and go YouTube it, Al Campanis on Nightline.
The buoyancy.
Blacks, why don't you have a good blacks, a lot of black swimmers, or a lot of black, but they're really nice people, and a lot of them are my friends.
Yes.
And it's true, though. Look at that period. In that period, you probably had the biggest boom of black hiring in the history of American professional sports.
Well, no, it was after the Rooney Rule came in, when they thought Johnny Cochran was going to take him to court.
And true, but if you look at Campanis was 87, right? Mm-hmm. Wayne Fonts, if you count him, gets a job.
Yes.
Art Shell gets a job. Ray Rhodes gets a job.
Well, Ray Rhodes was a bit later, though, right?
A little bit later, yeah. But Dusty Baker gets a job. Cito Gaston gets a job. Frank Robinson gets hired again, right? All of a sudden, Don Baylor gets hired. So within that five-year period, suddenly you had black coaches.
Yeah, that's fair. Like, if Johnny did it, though, the NFL went and got like 6 or 7.
That's true. They were like, that is true.
Hey, Tony Dungy, you got some friends? Oh, okay, cool.
Hey, Tony, we'll even get you a quarterback.
Yes. By the way, how much would you pay to walk up to Wayne Fonts and tell him that Mike Tirico used to say he was Italian?
Oh my goodness.
I would love to see the look on Wayne Fonts' face. And Wayne Fonts and Mike Tirico looking at each other like, huh, what's up? Like, they may not see this, but I do.
Although Wayne Fonts don't never hit it, though.
Yeah.
You know, Wayne Fonts never hit it. I mean,
I say he didn't hide it, but somehow it never came up.
But it never came up, exactly.
I will say this, though. The blackest thing about Wayne Fonts is in 1996, at the age of 56, he was let go as the coach of the Lions, never to be a head coach again.
Never to be a head coach again. Never got a second chance, right?
Yep.
And what's funny about that is that, but it is true, though, growing up down there, growing up down the South Shore, it was very clear that the Cape Verdeans did not always claim that blackness, if ever.
Time out.
What?
Wayne Fonts really had them convinced, Howard. In the fall of 1987, Fonts pleaded guilty to driving while intoxicated after an incident in which he was originally also charged with possession of cocaine. The more he's serious charge was drop, however. That's all I'm saying. or he did an amazing sell job on this one, right? Like, that's all I got. But if you got caught with some blow in 1987 and you kept your job as a coach.
That's true.
You know what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying? That's all I'm that's all I'm saying, man. Like, I don't know how we wound up in the Wayne Font's place to bring this thing home, but I hope the people found themselves entertained. They go look at that picture of Wayne Font's, they're gonna be like, oh yeah, I know what you're talking about.
I know what you mean. You know? I seize it now.
Deion Sanders taking us all over 1980s and 90s and everywhere else. But that is Howard Bryant. Check him out at Metal Art Media. Check him out at ESPN. Also, go on Amazon and Google his name. There's a whole lot of books you can buy. I recommend that you get up on one of them. Check the Ricky book. That's the most recent one. The book on Ricky Henderson. Actually, I should have thought about this earlier. Like, Ricky Henderson, Deion Sanders comparisons as people, where I feel like Ricky Henderson is the same guy with far less strategy. He just out here trying to make it happen and ask for money here and there, but Deion has a plan.
Had a plan. Oh, and by the way, they was teammates.
They were. Ricky was still there.
With the Yankees.
For like 15 minutes, but Ricky was still there.
For about 22 whole minutes.
Can you imagine? Was that Stump Merrill managing that team, or was that Bucky Dent? Or like, I forget which one of those terrible managers it was. But you imagine being the manager that has Ricky Henderson and Deion Sanders, and I'm pretty sure Winfield was still there.
Winfield was still there, out for the season. Bad. No, Winfield was still there. Traded to the Angels. 89. And also, Mel Hall.
Oh, I forgot Mel Hall was on that team. The man who once had a 37-second home run trot.
The man who's still in prison and took a high school girl to a prom.
Oh, forgot about that. Like, I would love to hear Don Mattingly's off-the-record conversations from 1989 about what in the hell has happened to this team. Like, Don Mattingly's like, I had to put up with all of that, and he couldn't just hang on for one more year to get that ring. He just needed, they took it away from him in 94 when the season got canceled. He couldn't
man,
hang
they
on
probably
for
looked
one
at Donnie.
More year.
They probably looked at Donnie in that clubhouse and said, yeah, we got to retire his number no matter what.
Like, we need to do it today.
We got to do it now.
What the man has done for us cannot be ignored. But hey, man, ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this 3 times a week. Adi Khan, Dan Stancic, Parker Owens handling things behind the scenes. Thank you, gentlemen. Remember, follow The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. We'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or follow on the ESPN app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.